So the important parts, the three important things about senders and receivers. One, independent of mechanism of concurrency. It runs with thread pools, it runs with coroutines, it runs with interrupts, right? So that's one of the things that makes it very amenable to application, either in the big data space or in the tiny embedded space with interrupts. Very important. Second important thing, it is asynchronous function composition, right? If you think about it like that, that's another very easy way, a good way in to think about it. Nothing happens when you declare senders. You can declare these things all day. You can compose them all day. No work happens at that point. It only happens when you say, kick off the work. And the third important thing is the what's called structured concurrency, which is to do with lifetimes.
Welcome to ADSP, the podcast, episode 231, recorded on April 9th, 2025. My name is Connor, and today with my co-host Ben, we chat about senders and receivers, FlatMap, and more.
My other topic was talking about senders and receivers, you know, because you and Bryce often talk about parallelism, concurrency. And so I thought it might be interesting to talk about senders, which are, you know, in C++ 26. And I wanted to, Bryce made a claim that I want to rebut, or finesse, maybe. So Bryce made a claim in a previous podcast that, I have a quote here. Today we live in a parallel world. Almost every hardware platform is parallel from the smallest embedded devices to the largest supercomputers. I would finesse that by saying that embedded devices have concurrency, but not much parallelism. And therefore that almost all hardware platforms in the world today have no parallelism because almost all hardware platforms are embedded devices. but it is certainly true to say they have concurrency, mostly in the form of interrupts. And so, you know, I thought maybe senders would be an interesting thing to talk about. You know, in particular to talk about, the two worlds that it addresses, you know, Bryce and you work for NVIDIA, you live in the world of huge hardware, right? Massive computation. Mm-hmm. I live in a completely different world, which is tiny hardware, no computation, but still concurrency, still the problem of concurrency in the form of interrupts. And senders, I think, addresses both worlds. For a long time, it was developed by folks firmly with their feet in the big hardware world. But, you know, the work I'm doing with my team, with Michael and with Luke, we are applying it to the very, very small, to the embedded, to the world of interrupts, not just to the world of huge, possibly heterogeneous hardware, large computation. So it's really interesting for me to sort of contrast those two ideas and yet recognize that I think senders has a good answer to both. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, so I think we should start off this topic.
It's a huge topic.
Having you give an overview of what senders and receivers, we've talked about it before. And admittedly, I said the other day when I was recording an Arraycast podcast, we were talking about Julia and the topic of multiple dispatch came up. And I said to the guest, you know, multiple dispatch is one of these things which I have a surface level understanding of, but I've never really, like, it's the Julia folks talk about how it's the killer feature of the language. And I'm like, I clearly don't understand it comprehensively enough to understand what the big deal is. And then even after he explained it, I think my understanding improved, but it still wasn't like, I 100% could go give a lightning talk on this. And I feel the same way about senders and receivers. My background on it, I've perused, I can't remember which version of the P2300 paper. I believe that was the last
number. I think number, we're up to at least R10.
Okay. At one point, I read most of, minus the, you know, the code snippets, that paper. And the most helpful thing that I had was, because Eric Niebler works at NVIDIA,
oh,
at
sure.
one point I, I grabbed an hour of his time, and he actually walked me through, admittedly, he was driving, I wasn't doing any typing, a bare bones implementation. And the thing that I've heard and I think understand is, you know, in Eric's words, what iterators are for serial algorithms, like in, you know, C++ 11, is what senders and receivers are for asynchronous algorithms. And I understood, you know, Eric's little presentation, and I understand at a high level, but I definitely don't. I'm in the same position with, you know, Julia's multiple dispatch. I don't feel like I could go give a 5-minute lightning talk and be like, you know, here's the explain the E, what is it? ELI 5.
Explain like I'm 5. I think I can probably give a good account of that in 5 or so minutes. I feel like I'm up to that.
And we should mention, I think it's been mentioned on the podcast before, but you yourself are in a position to do that because you have implemented basically a version of it yourself, which is the number one best way, in my opinion, to understand something comprehensively. Yes. Is just to implement your own version.
I have, it's not a completely standard version, but it is certainly, I have implemented senders and receivers in a code base, which will be in production. And certainly to the same platonic ideals as exist in the standard and to mostly the same interfaces. Some of the details differ.
Awesome. So over to you and help me and our listeners, because I guarantee you that more than 50%, maybe more than 75 or 90 are in the same boat as me.
Okay. So senders and receivers, firstly, it's a framework for expressing asynchronous computation. And the name's a bit of a misnomer. So, doesn't really give the idea of what it is, let's say. Really, senders, forget about receivers for a minute. Senders are asynchronous functions, right? So when you call a regular function, you give it arguments, you get a return value. When you call a sender, you give it arguments, you get a return value, but you don't get that return value through a return statement. Instead, that return value, we might say, goes on to the next sender as a continuation, right? So because this is asynchronous functions, we're not exactly executing it like, there are some similarities, we're not really executing it like a regular function stack and returning values. Instead, we're passing the values, the what would be the return values, onto the next continuation, which is the next sender in the chain. So at a very high level, that's what it is. So some things we can note. Senders and receivers is asynchronous computation embodied, and it does not therefore tie itself to any particular method of concurrency, right? So when you're writing an asynchronous system, there are three things which you want to separate. One is the expression of the functionality, the business logic, if you like. That's what senders is concerned with. But the other two things are, firstly, the mechanism of concurrency, if you're going to use thread pools or interrupts or you know, whatever, or deferred queue or whatever. There are many mechanisms we can use to achieve concurrency. Senders doesn't care, or coroutines, right? Senders doesn't care. You can use any of them. And the other thing is, like, what's the strategy of parallelism, right? Which things do we actually want to occur at the same time, properly parallel? And those three things, the business logic, the mechanism of concurrency, and the strategy of parallelism, we can separate out. And senders is concerned with expressing the asynchronous computation in a way that does not concern itself with the mechanism of concurrency. A sender is an asynchronous function, right? Mm-hmm. When you make a sender, it's just no work happens, right? You declare a sender, and you give it, you know, like some, like you might give it a lambda to do. Like the first, the simplest sender is called just.
Right.
And you give it a value. And when you run that sender, it will produce that value. In other words, it will send that value downstream to the next continuation, the next sender, rather than returning it like a function would.
So the senders are, when you compose these, you get a basically representation of a computation, but nothing happens. And then the strategy for parallelism and...
The strategy for parallelism comes in the ways that you compose senders together, or sometimes in the algorithms that you use to compose senders together. But the mechanism of concurrency, whether you use thread pools or coroutines or whatever, that's completely independent. So having declared our just sender, let's say we say, you know, just 42. So when we run it, it's going to just send 42. We can run that sender on the senders and receivers framework abstracts this to the idea of a scheduler. So a scheduler embodies the idea of where I'm going to run this. That you could have a scheduler that's tied to a thread pool. You could have a scheduler that's tied to an interrupt, an ISR. You could have a scheduler that's tied to, that does coroutines or whatever. A scheduler, you can ask it for a sender, and the sender that corresponds to a scheduler represents the entry point into the computation. It does nothing, but it just represents starting the computation on whatever computation resource that scheduler represents. So the very simplest one actually is just the scheduler that doesn't a regular function call, right? That's a perfectly valid scheduler. And it's called, I think, the inline scheduler, not to be confused with like inlining functions, but executes the computation in line in the current thread, just as if you had called a regular function, right? That's a perfectly valid scheduler. And when you ask it for a sender, it will give you back a sort of regular function. But then you can compose more senders with that. So you can say then is a sender algorithm that is fmap.
Right. Similar to the and then on the optional API that
exactly.
Cybran got into the standard and friends.
Yeah. So it receives what the sender before it sends. It transforms it and it sends on the result of the transform. It's like transform on vector, right? It's like and then on optional. It's working on the value, in this case, inside the sender chain. Mm-hmm. So this is, senders implement the continuation monad, just like vector implements the
list monad. Well,
the list monad, yeah, the list monad. And optional implements the maybe monad, right?
Right.
In the same way, senders implement the continuation monad. So you have the same kind of monadic ideas. They are not in C++ expressed in functional style, but they are given names that are cromulent with C++, right?
Right.
So we have just is like lifting a value into the monad, right? It's what Haskell calls pure or return. And when you say just 42, then you get 42 in your continuation, right? Mm-hmm. Being sent downstream. Then is like transform. We said let value is a third algorithm that is like then, except it doesn't return, it doesn't transform the value and return a new value. It returns a new sender, right? So it's like you can make a choice of which sender to run next based on a runtime value that came to you down the continuation. It's monadic bind, if you're familiar with that. And the purpose of monadic bind is to make that runtime choice when you have that data dependency, when what you run next depends on what was sent to you.
What is monadic bind in the like RxJS reactive world?
You mentioned concat earlier. It's map concat. It's transform reduce.
Map concat.
Well, so imagine your transform produces a vector from each element of your vector, and then you concatenate them all together in your reduction. Some languages call it flat map. Some call it map concat.
Okay. I mean, I definitely am familiar with flat map, but in my mind, that's like your taking a nested structure, and then this is when you need Google Translate.
Let's look at the optional version. We mentioned and then. Okay, so it's and then on optional, actually, because then is called transform on optional, and monadic bind or let value is called and then on optional.
Oh, no. So then is called transform. And then?
Because the function you pass to and then itself returns an optional. That's the key. So like you have a pipeline with optional where each step of the pipeline returns an optional result.
Right.
Like you go fetch some HTML content, right? Mm-hmm. You make a connection, the connection might fail. You fetch the URL, that might fail. Each step is basically a function from a sort of concrete thing, not the thing that's not optional, to an optional thing, right? And the way you chain them together is with and then.
Right. So, I mean, in a very simple case of this optional example, you know, transform takes a unary operation. Say we've got a optional of an int. It's got some value, right, and we want a plus one. You just send the lambda that you pass to the transform. Its signature is int to int, because it's gonna do the unboxing of the optional if it's there, and then calculate the value and put it back. Whereas and then its signature is int to optional.
The function you pass, imagine if you wanted to do,
or the function that you pass to and then,
imagine if you wanted to transform with taking a square root, right? Mm-hmm. What are you going to do if there's a negative number inside your optional? Your square root, not the standard square root, but you might choose to make square root return an optional, right? Because it can fail,
right?
It might be undefined. And so if you transform with that function, the result you get would be an optional int, right? Because you've taken the int inside the optional and you've transformed it to something that now produces an optional int. So you've got a doubly wrapped int in the optional.
Right.
So what you do instead of transform is and then, right? Which effectively collapses down those two optionals so that you stay in just a singly wrapped optional.
Interesting. This is, well, I don't know.
This is what monadic bind is.
Yeah, this is, I've always been a little bit confused by flat map, but I'm not sure if this is a eureka moment, but definitely I think my understanding of something is clarifying here, because there is a function, or this flat map, and what I am about to say could be wrong, and Ben will correct me if so, hopefully.
Okay.
That, like, you can think of if you want to go from, we'll go to array land, where, you know, you've got a matrix representable as a list of lists in any language like Python, or a vector of vectors in C++. And sometimes you want to turn that into a flat list and then maybe map, once again, plus one on that matrix. So you want to go from matrix to vector rank one array and then do an operation. And definitely in certain APIs there, you can do this with something like a flat map, where they, similar to the way that you can do a transform reduce in one call in C++, you could also do that with a transform followed by another call to reduction. And I know, like in Rust and other APIs, they have the map, they have the fold, but they also have algorithms called fold map or map fold or whatever. And so is this the case where, so my guess actually is where flat map in actually is not going from like 2D to 1D. It's you're in the list monad, aka a rank one vector list. You're doing some operation that could explode it to a list of lists, and flat map keeps it as, like, sure, you go to a mate. So instead of ending up with a list of lists, you're going to end up still with just a list because everything has been flattened, which the eureka moment that I was talking about is that, like, I'm conceptualized of going from like 2D down to 1D, but really it's 1D within your operation. You could go up, which is similar to the option of an option. If you have some failure, so you need to make sure that you've only got one level of nesting, basically, whether that's the list monad or the maybe monad. And so I think that there's a bit of conflating. Right. I'm sure there is an operation similar to fold map that is the flat map that actually goes from 2D to 1D. But in this case, the flat map that we're talking about, the monadic bind we're talking about, it just, you're at one level of nesting and you want to avoid, in certain cases, going up to two, whether that's a list of lists or an optional of optionals. Does that sound about right? So, and also maybe flat map in no language actually does this 2D to 1D. Maybe I've always just misunderstood flat map and it never does that.
Well, so there are a couple of ways to get there, right? You can maybe fuse elements of it in array languages, and also you can generate the list of lists and then concatenate them, or you can sort of go the other side. I think I'm thinking of it as like the other side of the square where you, I guess in the case of bind, it's effectively the same thing, but it's a map followed by join, if you like. Join is the other monadic term that gets used here. In Haskell, there's a function join.
Yes.
And map followed by join is bind.
Okay, well, so let's have a little tangent fun.
Yeah, we've come off of sender receiver. Now we're talking about. I've got another example, another maybe good example which might help.
But before we do that though, let's have this tangent fun, which is something that I've never really taken time to think about. And I apologize to the listener if we're about to lose you, but this is the kind of stuff that I know Ben spends time thinking about, and I should have. So join in Haskell corresponds to the W combinator, it sounds highfalutin what I just said, but it's actually quite simple. It takes a binary in the space of functions, which I actually don't know what is it. Is there a function monad? I don't actually know what.
Oh yeah,
is that the function monad?
Okay. Function composition. It's
is a type of monad. And so in array languages, it's super super simple. It takes a binary operation and it turns that into a unary operation by duplicating the argument. And that's actually in most array languages, it is called duplicate, even though it has a glyph or a symbol. Sometimes it's called self. And I think there's one other name for it. But the idea being that, like, you know, if you want to square something, that is just the W combinator applied to multiplication. Yeah.
So now think of your binary operation as a unary operation nested inside another unary operation, because in lambda calculus, that's how it might be expressed, right? You would bind one argument, getting back a partially applied function, wow, and then you would bind the second argument, and that is a binary operation.
Here I am thinking this is going to be like a 7-minute tangent, and then basically it took you 10 seconds, and like 3 seconds into your explanation, I was like, oh, wait, that's just... But that's a weird... I mean, so that...
So it's a function inside a function, yes, the same way as an optional inside an optional, or a vector inside, you know, a vector of vectors.
That is amazing. I hope that was... I mean, I got 3 seconds into your explanation, it clicked. And I've never understood how, I guess because I've never taken time to think about it, because it's actually pretty straightforward, that the equivalent of copying your argument to a binary function is just really nesting. Well, actually, no, now that I say that, I mean, it's not invoking the binary function. It's just like a, what you would call it, like a partial application.
Yeah, yeah.
And I guess in Haskell that works, because everything is technically like a unary function.
Right.
I mean, how
partial application is built in?
Could you build? I mean, I guess we have this on the optional interface, but like, how would you do this for functions? Would in C++? You do this with like bind first, just to call the bind first twice?
Yeah, I guess so. In C++, we don't have very good tools for function composition, but you could build similar things. Bind first might be part of it. We don't tend to express, you know, for historical and maybe for efficiency reasons, we don't express partial application very much. It's a fairly niche thing, but it is mathematically working out to the same thing as n-ary functions.
Yeah, I wonder what the disconnect of like trying to spell this, because like does this rely on, in a functional language like Haskell, does it rely on currying? Like, how are you able to apply this, like, nest yourself within yourself, and then you end up with a unary function? Like, there must be a way to do this in C++ with a function. Like, if you take std colon colon plus brace brace, like the function object. I mean, you definitely can write a lambda called w that like does the copying, but is there...
Yeah, yeah. And you can write a curry. You can write a curry function, a higher order function in C++. And a while ago, this was a topic of discussion at my meetup where we sort of worked it out, and I think Jason put it in one of his talks.
Yes, I recall seeing this a while back. Anyways, all right, I'll think about the C++ side of this, but definitely that, well, it makes 98% sense minus the C++ piece.
So we strayed a little bit from senders. Actually, the other
example,
the other intuition I was going to give for join or map concat was imagine writing a chess program, right? So imagine a very simple chess programs these days are much more involved, obviously. Mm-hmm. But imagine you're in 1985 writing a naive chess program. You're fundamentally what you're going to do is look at the position, generate all the moves that could be made, right? From those moves, from those new board positions, again, generate more moves. Mm-hmm. You know, you're generating a tree of board positions based on moves, and then you're scoring them, obviously. But just considering the generation, you start with your one board position, the current one, and you produce N new board positions based on the moves that can be made. Each one of those N goes on to produce M more, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Based on moves that can be made from that position. You want to collapse all these down, you know, in the process of scoring them, you're also, selecting the new best board position, right? And so it's that kind of operation where you are generating each board position can generate N. So that's your function from value to like list of values, right? You're in the list monad here.
Yes, that makes complete sense. And to clarify, from my understanding, is that you're reducing this list. The flattening happens at every step. You're not doing like the
They
call it, what did AlphaGo? It was the MCTS, Monte Carlo tree search. That one goes out N steps.
Yeah.
And then after a certain number of steps, it chooses the best path and then repeats. Whereas this one, your tree search is...
Well, you want to flatten it down, yeah. I think one of Bartosz's talks that he gave at C++ Now, maybe 10 years ago, had this. He talked about the N queens problem, which is very similar.
Right, right.
You know, so you're trying to... You put a queen down... And then that constrains the space. There are only so many spaces you can put another queen down. But there is more than one place, right? And so you are searching this tree of boards, of valid positions, and he uses a monadic approach to do that.
Interesting. Well, I'll see if I can find that talk. I definitely know I haven't seen all of Bartosz's C++ Now talks. I've seen a couple, but I don't recall seeing that one. So, I mean, to bring it back to senders and receivers, how does this... We now go to the continuation.
Which I feel now I have not given the 5-minute explanation.
Well, I was going to say, you mentioned continuation monad after the first 5 minutes. So I think probably the first 5 minutes you were good. Then you said that, and then I was like,
So the important parts, the three important things about senders and receivers. One, independent of mechanism of concurrency. Mm-hmm. It runs with thread pools. It runs with coroutines. It runs with interrupts, right? So that's one of the things that makes it very amenable to application, either in the big data space or in the tiny embedded space with interrupts. Mm-hmm. Very important. Second important thing, it is asynchronous function composition.
Right.
Right? If you think about it like that, that's another very easy way, a good way in to think about it. Nothing happens when you declare senders. You can declare these things all day. You can compose them all day. No work happens at that point. It only happens when you say, kick off the work, wait for the calculation to finish.
Right.
Right. So senders are descriptions of work. They aren't kicking off the work. The work kicks off when you say something like sync wait, which is an algorithm that consumes a sender, or remembering that a sender is a composition of senders, potentially, right? These things are infinitely composable. So when we say a sender, we might mean a single, like just, or we might mean a whole chain of just produce, then do this, then something else, then, right? Senders are composable. And the third important thing is the what's called structured concurrency, which is to do with lifetimes, right? So when you're in regular function call land, synchronous function call land, you have a stack. And the lifetimes of your variables are implicit because of that function call stack, right? So when you call a function, everything, the parameters you pass in, like references to variables on the stack, those variables stay alive during that function call, because it's only when the function returns that the current stack is popped. And, you know, the stack ensures that the lifetimes of variable arguments cover the lifetimes of the functions you call them with. Mm-hmm. Right. And there's a similar thing happening with senders, except that it's not a stack. These things are called operation states. So when you connect a sender to a receiver, the resulting thing is the operation state. I'll talk about receivers in a sec. But the operation state is that lifetime object. That's where the state lives for the computation. That's the object whose lifetime covers the computation. Mm-hmm. Right? And because senders are composed together in a very similar way, operation states get composed together and they form this kind of what's been described as an onion of states that the outer states wrap the inner states, right? And so the lifetimes of the variables persist, and it's the lifetime of the variables in the outer skin, and then in the skin inside that, and the skin inside that, all the way down to the center of the onion. Similar to a function called stack, where you can think about variables living at levels of the stack, you can think about variables living on layers of the onion.
Okay, I think that makes sense, yeah.
And the first sender that you run is the innermost part of the onion, right? When that completes, the next sender in the chain is the next level of onion skin, and the computation proceeds all the way out to the outer layer. When the final sender completes, the lifetime of the whole object is over. So that's how, when people talk about structured concurrency, that's what they mean. It's this framework takes care of lifetimes in a way that can be reasoned about, similar to the way we reason about lifetimes on the stack when we call functions.
Right. It is interesting, you know, in this conversation, you know, for better or for worse, unfortunately, I've probably steered this in a less digestible thing because I got excited about understanding join. But there is this, like, I don't know if it's isomorphism is the correct word, but when you think about, you know, the list monad versus the, we'll call it function monad, even though that's might not be what it's called, and then the continuation monad, which we're talking about, and they call each of these operations different things, there really is like a one-to-one like equivalence almost. Like you can think of, you know, senders and receivers give you the ability to represent an asynchronous graph of like computation, and you can think of it in a way like if you take a bunch of functions that, you know, take parentheses and multiple arguments, and you nestedly, mm-hmm. like Russian doll, call these in a different order. That's a way of representing like a graph of computation, right? Like you have to, you know, work your way down to the most inner functions, evaluate those, pass it back up. The same way with combinatory logic and combinators, you can chain, you know, operations together, which is also going to represent like this. And my guess is that this senders and receivers, because it's the continuation, you could actually use this to build versions of all these different, like you said, because it's separating.
Yes,
the
you can
not that that's the way to teach this or explain this, is which is why I said for better or for worse. This is the kind of the where the but we can revisit this topic, and
it's true, the continuation monad is very powerful and can express other monads. In fact, there's a blog post out there where someone calls it, I think, the mother of all monads.
Yeah, I'll find that blog, link that blog, and
we can also observe, of course, that asynchronous computation is a superset of synchronous computation. In other words, we can express synchronous computation in an asynchronous way. We can't do the other way around, but you can always collapse an asynchronous computation into a synchronous one by running it on the aforementioned inline scheduler that just does function calls. And so this, there's a lot of machinery in senders, but it can all boil down to exactly, if you actually want to run it synchronously, it boils down to nothing less efficient than function calls.
Right.
And like everything in C++, if you run it asynchronously, the idea is that it runs exactly as efficiently as if you had hand coded everything.
Yeah.
At least as efficiently.
It makes me think of some of the things that I look at for work are Jax, which is a library out of Google, and CuPy, which is a GPU accelerated like version of NumPy. And both of these have decorators in Python that you can use to basically JIT compile certain functions. And internally, they will once again create a graph of computation based on the function calls, and then they see what they can optimize. And so you're building a graph, mm-hmm. but in the simplest case, you can just have a function that linearly calls one thing and then another thing and then another thing, and then your graph is just a linked list, right? Which is just serial computation. Like, I mean, technically, a linked list is a graph. It's just a very simple one, right?
Yeah, yeah. And if you run it on an inline scheduler, it more or less literally becomes a regular function call stack.
Yeah.
So the other thing we can, so I haven't mentioned receivers yet. Receivers, the proposal is often called senders and receivers. The important thing really is the senders. They're what express the computation. The receivers mostly don't occur in user code. They're mostly used for the glue between the senders that algorithms use to plug these things together. One of the important things that senders gives us is not just the happy path called the value channel, right? If everything goes right, you're on the happy path. You're in the value channel. Everything's succeeding. But also there are two other channels, the error channel, right? When something goes wrong, you want to be able to handle an error. You want to be able to potentially short circuit the computation, error out and handle it a different way. And the cancellation channel or the stopped channel, right? You want to be able to tell from the outside this thing to stop because something else changed in the world and you're no longer interested in waiting for the result, right? Events have overcome it. And these are really important, and these are also built into the sender's framework. Mm-hmm. So every sender can complete in those three different ways, with a value, with an error, or by having stopped. And every receiver handles those three channels. And so this is built into the idea of the framework of asynchrony with senders. The capability of canceling the work or handling an error, as well as just staying on the happy path. Now, because senders are completely agnostic about the mechanism of concurrency, the cancellation has to be cooperative. There is no stop the thread or anything like that, because senders don't know anything about threads or coroutines or whatever else you're using for your mechanism of concurrency. So you don't get to preempt them or anything like that. What you get to do is request that they stop, right? And they have to take heed of that request to be good citizens, which, you know, they will do, because at the end of the day, you will be writing the business logic.
Right. Is this one of, I mean, my memory is failing me now. I remember when Bryce and I were talking to Sean Parent, he gave a talk at, I want to say, yeah, it was an Adobe office in New York for a meetup, and he presented, I think it, since then he's probably presented at a conference. He chains. Yeah. And he was pointing out a potential flaw in the, or flaw, quote unquote, you know, a trade-off in the design of senders and receivers, and that was what chains was addressing. Was this it, or was that something else? Because
chains... I did see Sean's talk at C++ Now, but I don't remember all the details. But
yeah,
well, I think chains is basically an alternative way of expressing asynchronous function computation. It's not so very different from senders and receivers, but it's a little bit different in the details. And it's a trade-off. I think it's a different, slightly different design. I think in particular, one of the things perhaps that, and I'm sort of talking just based on remembering now, there's a design choice to be made about external control of lifetime. Like, if I delete the object, am I allowed to delete the object? Should that result in a request for it to stop? Should that result in unwinding the chain of computation? There are different choices that can be made there. And I think chains makes a different choice than senders in that regard.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll have to go back and rewatch that. Or, I mean, when we bring Sean back on, because we already mentioned him two episodes ago, we can just ask him directly. So yeah, I mean, I feel like I have a better understanding. But like when you start talking about the onion analogy of wrapping the state, operation state, mm-hmm. My head immediately goes to like, how would I implement this? And I feel like I would still, it would take me a while to go and implement. I don't know. Every once in a while, it's like I have this, a better surface level understanding, but still, could I go and implement this thing like right now, snap of the fingers? And I probably could, but I would struggle. Whereas, you know, something like a combinator model, I can go implement that with my eyes closed because I.
Sure.
And I wonder why that is, though. Like, what is.
Eric can sit down and implement a simple version of senders and receivers.
Exactly, with his eyes closed.
A few hundred lines of code with his eyes closed. I have to say, in my implementation, I found, you know, there are some C++-isms that you have to kind of dance around a little bit. But the design of it is really very simple under the hood. And once you grok the design, and once you just sort of get the hang of a few different implementation patterns, the implementation is really nice. It just sort of falls out very nicely. Mm-hmm. It's not difficult at all to, in general, to add new algorithms, to add new sort of ways of combining senders, that kind of thing. It all fits together very nicely in my experience.
Yeah, I know, Eric, that's one of the things that when I've chatted with him is that, you know, he shows this kind of base set of algorithms mm-hmm. and senders. But right. similar to how Stepanov was always saying, you know, this is just the initial set, you know, there should be multiples mm-hmm. more, you know, there should always be an underscore, the counted version of the underscore n versions. And there should be tons more. And don't just stop at what the standard library gives you. Is Eric has said the same thing in designing these and proposing them, is that this is just the core set, but you know, it should give you the ability to write a world of asynchronous algorithms for all your different, you know, types of computation that you want to do.
Yeah,
which is exciting that we're getting it in the standard, because then hypothetically speaking, down the road in 10 years there should be a bunch of asynchronous algorithms that you'll have access to readily available in your
right
standard library near you, or 15 years, however long it takes. The it can take time. And so have you, I'm not sure if we want to kick this because we've already gone past time a while. Maybe we should do senders, receivers part two, and you can talk about some of the algorithms that you've ended up designing.
Sure.
Because that's something that I've spent very little time, working with.
Yeah, yeah. We can put that on ice for today and talk about it in the future. It would be great if we could talk to Eric as well.
Yeah, I'll reach out. I know he is he's a busy guy. He's juggling like several things right now. Committee work, the internal implementation of std execution, and now there's a whole new other C++ equivalent of a Python initiative that he's spearheading as well. So he's a very busy guy, but I'm sure if I mention that we want to chat about senders and receivers. I know he's given talks at CppCon, and it's been one of his life mission is to make this a more understandable topic, because it does for some reason seem to be mm-hmm. a thing that it takes a couple times, including for me, for people to hear it. And I know that there's more and more folks. You are one of them. Is it Dietmar? And there's a few other folks that, like, at first it was just Eric, and then now that I know that there's a handful.
Yeah, I think Rob Leahy has been doing some stuff as well.
Yeah, past guests on the podcast. So it is becoming a more, well understood and topic. So part one in the books, part two,
all right,
maybe with Eric, TBD. All right. Well, I know we had the schedule for 10, 30 minutes ago, but
a bit over time.
I should just start booking these for 2 hours, because I don't think we've had a single conversation and you say in general, I book off more time, or like, you know, in your head at least.
Well, we end up recording a month's worth of podcasts whenever we get together, something like that.
I think this will probably be three, even though we have the time, the recorded time enough. But I feel like splitting up the SNR one into two would be doing our listeners a disservice, because I try my best, because I get enough complaints about the slicing halfway through a topic, and then they're like, why do you do that? And a lot of folks I've realized, they actually wait for like all four parts, and then they'll listen like a month later,
and all listen together
all at once.
Okay.
Which isn't a bad strategy. I prefer, you know, as soon as things are out to listen to them. But yes, if you just finished listening to this, I took the time to edit the extra 20 minutes. But yeah, we'll do this again, and I'll reach out to Eric.
Cool.
And see if we can get him on. And to the listener, till next time, be sure to check these show notes either in your podcast app or at adspthepodcast.com for links to anything we mentioned in today's episode, as well as a link to a GitHub discussion where you can leave thoughts, comments, and questions. Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed, and have a great day.
I am the anti-brace.